copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Greg Pritchard, who organizes this, is very keen on 7-somethings or 10-somethings or whatever it might be. And in my case, he wanted me to deal with the 7 commonest management mistakes. So I did, and I actually came up with your I can't remember if your notes say 7 or 9 or whatever it might be. The fact is there are probably 777 management mistakes that we can make. So these are just some that I have come across in my own life and in the life of other people. So I want to encourage you that mistakes are things that happen regularly in most people's lives, and most certainly in mine. I've had the pleasure, the privilege, really, of working alongside some amazing Christian leaders over time. People with drive and commitment and imagination, creativity. They've been really impressive people. And God has used people like that to achieve the most extraordinary and astonishing things at different times. But what I find challenging is that sometimes things can go badly wrong for people in that situation, and can at least either temporarily or even permanently derail the things that they've been involved with doing, and how sad that that should be so. It's the fact is that what I find is that great leaders can sometimes be deficient in some of the most basic management disciplines. And people ask sometimes, well, come back here. What's the difference? What's the difference between leadership and management? There was this ad in the Wall Street Journal that said, let's get rid of management. If you want to manage somebody, manage yourself. Do that well and you'll be ready to stop managing and start leading. That sounds great wisdom, but one of my instructors at business school, John Cotter, he has this saying, leadership is about coping with change, and management is about coping with complexity. And I find that actually quite a helpful distinction between perhaps what is the art of leadership and the science of management. That, in a sense, management is about making things work, making them work well. Whereas leadership is about something, in a sense, bigger, a bigger scope. But the two work very well together. We need charisma and vision and drive. They're great. But I've found over time that we need some management skills in order to harness them and make them effective. So, in going on and talking about these mistakes, they are mistakes that people can make, that I myself have made. And it's my aim is really to be helpful rather than critical. But I think as you look at these things, as we work through them, perhaps you'll start to get a sense of where we can actually make an adjustment in the way we manage things that help us to be more effective leaders. So, without more ado, let me go to the first one, which I've called, I'm sorry for the English pun, eyes and nose. I love this quote from Sam Goldwyn. I don't want any yes men around me. I want everyone to tell the truth, even if it costs him his job. The mistake that I'm talking about here is the tendency of leaders often to surround themselves with people who agree with them. People who are simply yes men or yes women. and see anybody who disagrees as an inconvenient nuisance. You see, the problem is that when we only get fed yeses, it means that there's no room for challenging our thinking. There's no room for questioning whether we're on the right track. So surrounding ourselves with yes people is actually hostile to the whole idea of being able to lead well and lead effectively. Governance, of course, is a way of arranging that. Sometimes people, leaders, appoint boards of directors who are simply compliant, who go along with everything that they say, who nod faithfully when suggestions are made or when proposals are put before them. And the trouble with that is that sometimes we can get headed off on the wrong track. What we most need are people who will question us, who will probe when we put something before them, who maybe suggest alternatives, different ways of thinking about it. Somebody who's actually willing to say, I just think that's not the right way to go. And that can be very uncomfortable, especially if this is our baby, our thought, our creation. Somebody saying no to it can be very difficult. But maybe even better, somebody who says no, but maybe we could make it work this way instead. That's a gemstone. When I worked for a while in Romania at Emmanuel University in Oradea, we had a great leader, Paul Negruț, who was really held accountable by two very senior leaders, and they would come and visit. One is Lord Griffiths, a member of the House of Lords in the UK, and one was Bill Pollard, who is the former chairman and chief executive of a large public company in the USA. And these two men would come, and they were not experts at running a university, but what they were expert at was asking questions, and they would ask the most penetrating and difficult, challenging questions that really made Paul stop and think. And they didn't do it in a threatening way. They didn't do it so as to make him feel bad, but rather to explore, to widen the canvas, to push the boundaries of thinking. And as leaders, we need that. We need to be pushed to think more deeply. So let me ask you, as a leader, to think about this. Do you have people around you who will feel free to push you? People who will feel free to challenge you on a decision or question your thinking or stimulate alternative ways of thinking, alternative approaches to what you're working on? Ask yourself that. Who is doing that for me? Who challenges me to think differently? Now, it has to be said that there are sometimes people who will say no, who are critics, who are malicious, who are negative always, and we certainly don't need those. If you're a pastor in a church, you'll probably come across some of those. Sadly, sad to say. People who write to say how much they disagree with your sermon. I had a lady, I preached a sermon a few weeks back, and I had a lady come out of the church, and she said, "I think you were completely out of order in what you said there." Well, we agreed to disagree. But so you will get that. And I'm not really talking about that. I'm talking about somebody who disagrees, who challenges constructively, because they want the best out of what your organization's doing. So, let me push it over to you for a few minutes. Ones in twos or threes, just share some experiences that you've had of good challenges that you might have experienced. People who've changed your thinking, and see how it's made a difference. Bill Hybels of Willow Creek, thank you. Bill Hybels. He had a very helpful definition that I found useful, which is when the question of people agreeing positively or agreeing negatively. The question to ask, really, he said, is do they share the vision? If they share the vision that you have and they're saying no, that's hugely helpful. If they don't share the vision, then probably their rejection of what you're saying or doing is probably not particularly helpful. And that's a way of telling it apart. So, these are really the action steps that I would suggest you need to be thinking about. Think about people whose minds and abilities you respect, people who share your ultimate vision, and talk to them. Get them onto your side, onto your board, onto your advisor group, so that they can challenge your thinking. Tell them you want to have your thinking challenged and questioned. Consider appointing a group of advisors, if you're in a leadership position that enables you to do that. Because the more fresh air and transparency that we can bring into our leadership process, the more effective it will be. I think a great text to close this point is Psalm 141, verse 5, which says, "Let a righteous man strike me, it's a kindness. Let him rebuke me, it is oil on my head, and my head will not refuse it." So, Psalm 141:5. Let's move on. Which I've called present pleasure and future pain. Most of us hate to be the bearers of bad news. We hate to be the ones who disappoint somebody. We hate to be the messenger that makes them angry or is going to make them feel sad or low. And so often our reaction is we don't say anything. We hope the problem will go away and solve itself. So we leave it alone. It's natural enough. The problem is that a problem left alone and not tackled will sooner or later come back to bite us. Over and over, I find that people shrink from bringing bad news. I think it's partly a cultural issue. I find in particular in the country where my wife and I grew up, in Kenya, in Africa, people don't like to bring bad news. So they tend to tell you what they think you will like to hear, rather than what you will not like to hear. I think that happens in Eastern Europe quite a bit. I found it certainly in Romania when I was there, that people didn't like to bring bad news. And so, as a result, they find all kinds of ways just to avoid the issue rather than confronting it openly. Sometimes it's called the difference between instant gratification and deferred gratification. Instant gratification, we want to feel good now. So we put off the evil moment as far as possible. We try to avoid the pain of telling somebody something now, but we store up for ourselves much worse pain if we don't tell them now and they find out later on. At one time, the organization that I was working with had needed to be able to raise funds in the United States, needed a place where money could be sent to so that it could be transferred to Europe for use in the organization. And we had an agreement with a charitable organization, a foundation in the US, which was working okay. It wasn't great. But we decided that we would set up our own foundation, which would be able to raise funds in the US and bring that money across to use in the work here. But we didn't say anything to the agency that we were working with in the US. And we went through the process and we set up this organization, this foundation in the US for ourselves. And then we were going at some point to tell this agency in the US that we didn't need them anymore. And they had obviously put a lot of effort and time and commitment into the work. And then somebody wrote to them saying, "We're not going to give to you anymore. We're going to give to their own organization, their own charitable organization." So we got a phone call. "What's all this about? You setting up your own foundation? Why didn't you say anything?" It was highly embarrassing. And the only reason was because we had shrunk from telling them the plain truth that we thought it was time that we stood on our own feet, that it was a necessary step, that it was something that we should do. But it caused a huge amount of hurt and aggravation. How unnecessary. What a pity that we hadn't actually tackled the issue and talked about it. So, let me ask you to think about this for yourselves. How good are you at confronting things? One of marriage preparation course that we have in the UK talks about people being either hedgehogs or rhinos. Hedgehogs, when they come across a difficulty, a problem, a disagreement, they curl up into a ball with just prickles on the outside. That's what a hedgehog does. Some people are quite different. They're like rhinos, and they charge at the problem. Bam! Creates a lot of dust and a lot of noise, but it at least gets to the bottom of the problem quickly. So hedgehogs or rhinos? What are you, a hedgehog or a rhino? When was the last time you broke bad news to somebody? How timely was it? Did you delay for a long time before passing it on? You see, being a rhino can be painful, but it can create a lot of dust. But at least it gets to the problem quickly. The hedgehog tends to go on being prickly, curled up into a ball. So, take a couple of minutes to talk to the person next to you. Are you a hedgehog or a rhino? And how do you deal with things? Okay, folks, let's bring it back together again. Now the thing is, if you're a natural hedgehog, it may be very difficult to turn yourself into a rhino. It's just not that easy. So, a couple of hints about things that you can do. If you are not a natural confronter, if you find it hard to confront, then maybe you need somebody alongside you in some way, or somebody who works with you who is good at confronting. You may need to get them involved in some of those things so that even if you're not that great at doing it, you've at least got somebody who will tackle the challenging things as they come up.
I have a question.
Yeah.
How do you qualify Elijah? Was he a hedgehog or a rhino?
I would say he's more of a rhino than he is a hedgehog. He's a rhino who got... He's feeling pretty sorry for himself. I think rhinos feel sorry for themselves sometimes because they've hurt somebody or they've said something, and the fact is that, you know, how you do something is also quite important. I don't think we need to slaughter the prophets of Baal. It was painful afterwards. So maybe he's not a natural rhino. He was just a rhino for God. I mean, that happens too. Sometimes we have to force ourselves to something and it's not comfortable. But sometimes we can get some help in this by having somebody near us who will do that. Our axe man or whatever. I think the Psalms again work here. Psalm 32, when I kept silent, my bones wasted away. For day and night your hand was heavy upon me. And then I acknowledged my sin to you and did not cover up my iniquity. You see, it's the keeping silent that causes the real pain. When I said, I will confess my transgressions to the Lord, you forgave the guilt of my sin. I'm going to move on because time is running away, the great enemy. So let's go to this one. I'm going to not spend too much time on this one. The all-rounder. Leaders sometimes think that because they're the head honcho, the top person, they need to be good at everything that everybody does in the organization. They need to be better than anybody else in the organization at the jobs that those people do. My father was a chaplain in Kenya, and on one occasion he was driving his car with the bishop of the top man of the diocese that where he was working. And they were driving the car together and the car broke down. Now my father had been running a trucking company for a long time. He knew engines, he knew mechanics. And the bishop was a bishop. And I think he'd not always been a bishop, obviously, but he'd always been a clergyman. The car broke down, my father lifted the hood, the bonnet, and they both peered inside. And then the bishop took charge. And the bishop actually, within a couple of minutes, it was clear the bishop didn't know anything about engines whatsoever. But because he was the bishop, he thought that he needed to be able to solve the problem. And the fact is, he didn't have the expertise to do it. He thought that he had to be the one to solve the problem. I wonder how many leaders think that just because they're the head of the organization, they need to be on top of every job that's done in that organization. Really, here, we need to learn how to allow other people to be good at their jobs without us as bosses needing to show them how to do it. It does help, of course, to know how to ask the right questions. And so we need to know enough about what's going on, about how the organizations run and how it works and who does what, to be able to ask those good questions. But it doesn't mean that we have to know, for instance, how to program a computer. and then to try to tell somebody how to do it. The fact is, no head, no chief executive, no leader is expected or should expect to know every detail about what goes on and how it's done in their organization. If asked, they need to be able to describe with enthusiasm what goes on and how it's done and what the strategy is and what the plans are and what the vision is, of course. But that doesn't mean knowing all the bookkeeping details and the down to the nth degree of detail. So, I suppose the things that I would put to you here as we analyze it, what questions do I really need to be asking in my organization? What answers do I want? How much detail do I really need to have on the things that go on? And if the answer is everything, then you've not been listening. If there's a question that I don't know the answer to, is it something I really need an answer to? And if it is, then who should I ask it? Can I cheerfully admit to not knowing everything, but knowing what's important to know? And if when you go through those questions for yourself, you find you're anxious because you don't know everything, then you'll find you're being a bit like the bishop and trying to know everything about what everybody does, which isn't really necessary. The question is, have you got competent people that you can trust in your organization? People that you can give things to do and they will respond. What are the 5 to 10 most important things that you need to be focused on in the organization? And can you let the other things go? And learn to ask good questions rather than expecting to have good answers yourself. It's when you ask the good questions, that's when you're really doing the job of the leader. So onward. Too busy to stop being busy. I always remember a scene that my wife described. She'd been asked to help organize this reception at the university in Romania when we were there. A reception for the graduates and their families. And Anne, who's sitting at the back there, is a really good cook. She's really good at catering. And so she was asked for her help, for her advice. So she went along when it was the preparation time, and she watched with great sadness the chef, the top guy in the kitchen, laying out laboriously cold meat and all kinds of things on platters, while 5 members of staff stood around watching him. Their job was to take the platter away when he had put all the stuff on it, arranged it beautifully. It looked wonderful. But as you may imagine, it was hours late for the reception because it was just the one man doing it while everybody else watched. You see, he thought of himself as the one that had to do it rather than the one that had to organize it and make sure it happened and give people the task. And if necessary, show them how to do it. If necessary, give them a demonstration, but then say, now you get on and do that. So it's really a lesson to all of us as leaders how easily we get sucked into the doing as opposed to the leading. You see, the problem is when you're immersed in the doing, it's very hard to step back and see what needs to be done. It's very hard when there's a banquet and there's lots of people are needing to be served. It's very hard if you're the leader not to get involved in immediately starting to clear the plates and put them away. Because your job is really to try to see how can you organize the serving staff to make sure that they are doing what needs to be done and they are going to the places where the work is really needed. Do you recognize anything of yourself here? Turn to the person next to you and talk about this a little bit. Where do you struggle? Where do you have problems in this area?
I think that problem is probably the one that I struggle with most myself. It's so tempting to want to get in and do it and fix it rather than standing back and making sure that it's getting fixed, but that doesn't mean you have to do the fixing. Now, I'm running low on time, for which I apologize. I know that things are running away. So I am going to therefore be selective, and I'm going to jump to one that I think is particularly important, and that is my number 6. I'm going to live forever. Real problem leaders face is how do I organize my succession? Who is going to follow me? You see, if you fell under a bus tomorrow, God forbid, who would take over from you? Do you know? Do you care? Now, you may have no immediate plans for stopping doing what you're doing, but of course, things do happen. It's not a good reason, just because you don't have any plans for stopping doing what you're doing, it's not a good reason not to be thinking about who is going to come next, who is going to take over from you at some point. Now, it may not be your responsibility to organize that. It may be that, for instance, you have a board of directors or of trustees or something like that who will be the ones who are responsible for appointing a successor. But if that's so, and if you are the leader, you still have a responsibility, you have an obligation, really, to be challenging that board to ask them, what are they doing about thinking about your successor? And how are they going to equip somebody to be able to do what you do effectively? And is there somebody already in your organization who could pick up your responsibilities? A deputy, perhaps, maybe temporarily? Or if they are a deputy and they could grow into doing what you're doing, what are you doing and what are they doing in order to prepare them for that work? Max Dupree says, succession is one of the key responsibilities of leadership. It's one of the things we don't like to think about because it's hard. Especially in small organizations, it's very hard to have much depth. You can't have people kind of stacked up like planes waiting to land. You can't do it. You just don't have the resources. You probably don't have the people. You don't have the space for them to be usefully occupied while they're waiting to step into your shoes. So these are some difficulties, but it doesn't mean that we shouldn't be thinking about it, or we shouldn't be holding others, our board, our advisors, whatever, responsible for thinking about it. Of course, as leaders, we do have that obligation to try and help to find somebody. Because if we don't, we condemn our organizations at best to a period of instability, or we're still just not being able to function effectively. If we believe in the mission of our organization, then we need to be prepared to think about how it's going to carry on. Where is it going to go? And who's going to be making that happen? So, what are we doing about it? Assuming it is yours, if it is your responsibility, or if you are helping to advise your board as to how they should find your successor, some things that we need to be thinking about. How far has the work gone that you're involved in? Are you about at the end of your creative or imaginative powers and now need some fresh thinking, some fresh blood? That might be a good reason to be thinking about what kind of a successor you need to have. It doesn't necessarily need to be somebody who is a clone of you. In fact, it probably shouldn't be a clone of you. It should probably be somebody who thinks in new ways, in fresh ways. If there is somebody in your organization that you could imagine taking it on, do they know that? Do they know that they could be your successor? And if they do, then how are they taking responsibility for helping themselves to grow into it? What training do they need? What kind of extra skills need to be sharpened in what they do? If you have such a successor, then that's great. Make sure that you are developing them, that you are pushing them to do what needs to be done to grow into what you want them to do. And that means that you need to be prepared for them to make mistakes, because they will make mistakes, probably. Mistakes you probably wouldn't have made. But the fact is that we actually learn from mistakes. Obviously, there's a limit to the number of mistakes, especially if you make the same mistake more than once. But mistakes happen, and we probably need to see it as part of the development process. If you don't have somebody already on board in your organization, then you may well need to be looking around for how that person should be identified and brought on board and then developed and trained for the work. It's probably not your responsibility alone, but you certainly, as a leader, share that responsibility, whether with other people, with a board, or whoever. The mistake here that we can make is to think that the problem is going to solve itself, because it won't. Or you can take the line of some of those kings in the Old Testament who, when they heard that bad times were going to be coming, they said, well, at least it's not going to be in my lifetime. I can forget about it. Well, we can't do that. As leaders, that's abdication, if we leave that to when we're no longer there. It may solve our headache, but it doesn't get the organization to where it needs to be. Anybody have something they want to ask?
Can you very quickly tell us what 5-7 were?
Yeah.
We'll be making questions too.
Sure. Five is called staying out of touch. And it's really about the art of communication. I love this quote. We know that communication is a problem, but the company is not going to discuss it with employees. You know, in church after church after church where I have been, when people complain about things, it's usually they complain about communication. And what they mean is they have not been part of the decision-making process or what goes on in the leadership team in the church. People feel left out. They feel in the dark. So to the extent we do need to bring, to the extent we can, we need to bring people into that loop of communication. And number seven, what they don't teach you at the Harvard Business School. And again, a brilliant quote. What I need is a list of specific unknown problems that we will encounter. What I'm saying here, actually, is that to rely purely on management techniques will not get us to where we need to be. They are very helpful. They are what makes the wheels go round smoothly. But I have perhaps three quick pieces of advice. One is keep a sense of proportion. Don't exaggerate the difficulty or the challenges of what you're dealing with. Keep a sense of proportion. If the main part of your day is being spent in basic administration, then perhaps you need to think again, what's the vision? What am I trying to do? What is it? What's the main strategy for how we're going to do that? Keep a sense of proportion. Second, keep a sense of humor. I mean, we need to laugh at ourselves from time to time, don't we? Because some of what we do is really ridiculous. So laugh at it. Recognize that we can take ourselves much too seriously at times. So let's actually step back and smile. And thirdly, it does help to keep a sense of what I'll call godly dissatisfaction. Godly dissatisfaction, where you don't accept things just as they are. You say, we can do better than this. We could do more or differently. We could have a greater impact if we did some different things. And that's a sense, when God is guiding that, and when we're getting his involvement in it, that's godly dissatisfaction. We're not satisfied with things as they are. We want to make them better in his strength. So, the Christian's secret weapons, prayer, brothers and sisters, to talk things over with, and the servant leader's attitude of humility, not thinking ourselves better than others, but thinking of others as better than ourselves. I'm going to stop there before I get into trouble. Thank you.
Thank you very much.